The
what?
The big bull. The big bull was discovered on the top of the clock.
That was after my time.
We that was 1929, I believe it was.
Yeah. Our manager from Kennicott went up there, B.B. Needing. He went up there and managed to mine up there. But there was no mining there except one Frenchman called Hilty, and he was rocking out a little gold up the river somewhere. He used to come down once in a while. There wasn't an axe mark on the river. I think the Indians had some kind of a superstition about that river, because they'd come through it, they'd come through on their boats. There was a bunch came through from, I think, Tetlin. They'd come down the incline, I think, or the Black and White, I forget which now. They'd leave a canoe up there. And they'd come down, take this canoe, and then come down and go to Juneau and get their supplies, go back up again in the fall. There was two boatloads came down when we were on the river, but that was the only people we saw. And away from the banks of the river, you couldn't find an axe mark. As I say, I think they had some kind of a superstition about the river, because there was nothing done at all there. It was a beautiful, beautiful place. We had a camp right in the canyon.
Were there any moose on the river in those
days?
Yes,
there were moose. Grizzly bear, goat, sheep up sat at the top. I think they say it was the only place that there was both kinds of sheep there, the doll and the stone up that river. As you could see, goats quite often. In fact, this Paddy Morrissey, he went hunting with Bill one day, and he caught a goat by hand. Never heard of before. Came round a rock, and for some reason the goat must have been asleep or something, but he threw himself at it and caught this goat by the leg, held him. Young one, of course.
Where did you go to next?
Well, as I say, we came out broke, and I went to Seattle to see my daughter, and I was in the fall. I met a mining engineer there that I'd known in Juneau, Dick Wilson. Very fine chap.
What year was this?
Well, sir, this was around, my wife died at 18. It must have been 19 or something like that. I went down to Seattle. Met this man Wilson. He was manager for the Carbonado Coal Company, Carbonado near Seattle. And he asked me what I was doing, and I told him. And I asked him if he had anything in my line of calling. He said he had a job at delivering coal to the miners. If I had a truck. I said, will you give me a contract if I get a truck? He said, yes. So I went down to a Nash dealer and promoted this truck. So I got this contract to work on it. I'm a little short of money. But I got the truck, and I got down to the, I didn't have $100. I got the truck anyhow. I was on the road out to Carbonado in a few days. I'd never driven before, but I had a friend there, John York, who had been my partner in the trapping business in the Copper River country. And he says, you ship the gear so, and this is one and two and so on. And I had about 15 minutes of that. I started it, stopped it, went into low gear and backed up. It was all right. That's where I went. I went on to Carbonado, started work the next morning. You didn't need any license in those days. There was no numbers or anything. There wasn't very much of the very many vehicles on the road. Nothing but horses. Horses. The road was covered with horses. Well, I got there and I had to back this truck under the sort of a bunker. It was quite a little maneuvering, but I managed it all right. Inside of a week, I could put that thing anywhere. It was one of the first trucks with pneumatic tires, by the way. And I stuck to that for 6 or 8 months or so. And miners came out on strike. They stayed on strike. And I, of course, I was nothing. Everything was shut down. It couldn't work. And Dick, Father said to me, he said, I told him I'd like to get out. Well, he said, we'll buy the truck from you for what? For your equity. So I sold the truck for all the money that I had in it. I'd been paid so much every month out of my earnings. And he paid me what I paid for the truck. I went back to Seattle. I got a job from the Kennicott people somehow. I forget what that was. The way I got back to Seattle, back up north again, was I met a man in Anacortes, old Bill Gilkey, an old Dawson miner and prospector. He told me he'd worked to lay for Skip Mitchell on number one El Dorado. And we played a game of pool together in the in the Elks Hall in Anacortes, and he says, "Why don't you come up to Alaska with me?" So I went back to Alaska not with him, but
what steamboat did you come up on?
I couldn't tell you that time. I tried to travel to all those steamships, but by that time I couldn't. But when I came first to the territory, I came in the old Portland. But I traveled the Alameda, I traveled the Mariposa, the Alaska, and all of them were on that run.
That brought you back to Kennicott, huh?
That brought me eventually back to Kennicott. Yeah, after I'd been into the Chistochina prospecting that summer.
That would be 21?
That would be 22 I was prospecting in the Chistochina, Middle Fork.
Is this the same fellow that you met in Seattle, that you went prospecting with?
This might have been another Cortes, that was his home.
Anacortes.
Yeah, Anacortes was his home.
How long did you stay in the Copper, in the McCarty area?
Oh, I was there from 1922 to the close of the mines, practically 1938 when mines closed down, yes.
And what did you do mostly?
Well, I was assistant storekeeper. I was storekeeper. I was metallurgical statistician. Acting postmaster. That's about all I did there.
Was Sigwald there at that time?
Sigwald was. He worked at the Kennicott for a while, and then he. he went down to McCarthy and went into business for himself. He used to run a taxi cab. He did everything. He was quite a rustler. He had agencies for the laundry, he had agencies. He had a taxi cab, he had a truck, he had anything that he could turn a penny on, he was there. He was a very energetic young man, very likable too, so he got lots of business.
And Reuben Johnson, did he have an airplane service there?
Reuben Johnson, he came to work as a millwright. He took a notion he wanted to learn to fly, so he took flying lessons and bought a plane, and we could look up and see there's Reuben, he's getting in his flying time, and he'd be floating around the place, zooming round and round, getting in his flying time. Then I think he did a little flying service. Yes.
Can you remember who taught him?
Oh, I have no idea. Yeah, I think there was two cook kids down there. These boys had to fly that flying school down there. What was their name? We called them cook, but their name is. What's the name of those two boys that had that flying service down here?
Down where?
Salt and Rich.
Oh,
they were two kids in their teens or less. Well, they bought an old plane and they taught themselves to fly. they splashed down in some place or another and busted up. At that time you could buy a plane from the government for salvage rates.
This is when you about came to the Tanana Valley now.
I came to the Tanana Valley in 1939. The last manager of the Kennecott Company, he was kind enough to try to find a job for me when the place was closing down. He spoke to somebody over at the FE, and the FE paid my way over to Fairbanks. And I started to work under Walter Pratt in the warehouse there.
Tell me, what was the reason of closing down those mines? I've heard several tales. I wonder how.
Well, the depletion of the high grade, or.
There's still a lot of ore there, isn't there?
There's ore, but it wasn't profitable for mining. I wondered if the advance in the price of copper would have kept open sometime longer. But the last year I was there, they spent $250,000 exploring, that is, driving. I was drifting across the formation to see what they run into. All the copper there is in big lenses with no particular system to it, so it was just a question of luck when they ran out of them. But the copper was liable to be there. But
I heard that there was a strike on the railroad that finally made the decision. Is that true?
Oh, I wouldn't say it's altogether true. Just as in the gold mining, the labor movement had something to do with closing the mines in Juneau. In fact, that was the principal reason. But it was the advance of the cost of labor and materials. It wasn't altogether labor, but it was labor and materials. And the same thing held true in the kind of got copper there.
I worked in the Tacoma Smelter in this early part of the war, 1917. We get in the Army, and we used to handle all that copper ore from there.
Yes.
And they shipped it down from
Jim Crawford was the assayer at Kennicott at the time I was metallurgical statistician. He came there, he was quite a lively young man. He had lots of hair in those days.
Crawford is with the FE now?
Yes, yeah. The first day after he arrived, he went jumping down the track to, just like a young man would, to limber up a little bit and come face to face with a bear. We turned around and came back home.
Well, when did you get married again, Al? Did you marry at Kennicott? Or?
I married at Kennicott. I met, coming back from Seattle in 1926, I guess. I was on a steamer Northwestern. My first mother-in-law happened just by chance. She was on it too. We didn't know.
These names we want. You didn't tell us the name of your first wife or your mother-in-law.
Well, my first wife was a granddaughter of a Dawson pioneer, Terence McManus. Her name was Gladys Swenson. And she was born in San Francisco in 1894, I think, or 96. She was 22 in 1918 when she died, I think, in 1996. Her maiden name was Swenson. She was a daughter of Genevieve Swenson. Their father had been dead long before, I think. The father died when she was an infant. I don't know anything about him. But they had lots of Dawson people come to Juneau to see them. The mother lived in Juneau, and lots of Dawson people. That's how I met lots of Dawson people, because they'd come to the house to see her. And the way I married the second time, and I say I was in this Northwestern, and at Ketchikan, a whole raft of school bums came from the Teachers Institute. They just flooded under that boat, filled up with school bums in no time. I met one of them at Miss Forrest, and got to know her quite well by the time we got to Cordova. I went up to Kennicott, and I hadn't been in Kennicott very long before Bert Needing sent me over to La Touche to work in the store there. And I had to get my glasses fixed, get some glasses, so I had to go to Cordova to see about some glasses. And I saw Miss Forrest again there. And then I got transferred back up to Kennicott. I saw her again. Did a little bit of salesmanship, and we got married in 1927. She came north. She finished up a teaching year that year, and she came north in 27 and married in November 12th.
In Cordova?
In Kennicott.
Kennicott.
What's the first name?
The name was Jane Forrest. The young man over there is the...
How did the two of you travel to Fairbanks then when Kennicott closed down?
Well, when Kennicott closed down, I told her to go back and see the people at home. And she went back to Iowa and took the boy. And, when I got settled, I sent her a telegram. She came up just about 4th of July, I think, in 19... 1939.
Yeah. Touche was quite a large mine too, wasn't it?
That's called the Beetson mine. Yes.
Yes, the Beetson mine.
I was there most of the winter. It's a very rainy, snowy place. It rains terrifically, 3 or 4 days on end. I think it's one of the rainiest places in the world. 200 inches, I think, is about the annual rainfall. B. Van Presley was the manager there. He was a wonderful man.
What kind of a mine was it?
Copper. Yes. Copper, it was a low-grade mine. The heads at La Touche were lower than the tails at Kennicott, if you understand what I mean. Mm-hmm. I was a metallurgical statistician. That was one of the most interesting jobs I ever had. I worked like a dog in a hand calculator. I took twine by the hour, but I had many, many calculations to make each day and fill out forms. You started with a guess and finished up with a certainty. And, I also kept the power statistics. And I worked like all of this. I had a large book that kept all these things and worked out the percentage of carbonate, percentage of whatnot. Eventually, how much copper we produced, and finally, how much the cost of copper was. And I was sending a telegram to the president of the company in New York. Cost of copper this month, 7.5 cents, or 7.something. And that's what controlled the mine. And the stoves were controlled the same way, you understand that. The mine foreman would come and ask me how much copper we had produced so far, and I'd tell him, and he had his orders, he had to produce so many pounds, and it was remarkable. He'd be told to produce he'd come within 300 or 400 pounds of the amount of copper that he had to produce, and that was really remarkable.
I've been there. I've never went into the mine, though. I went into the mill. I can't remember the year it was. It's so long ago.
Well, that must have been the... About how long were you being there, though?
I can't remember. I remember the manager, though. But I don't remember his name. Quite a character.
It wouldn't be Douglas. Wouldn't be. Douglas was the superintendent. Meeting was the manager. Then there was B. Van Presley. And it was also after La Touche closed down, Presley became the manager of Kennicott. Mm-hmm. Meeting had gone by that time.
Do you remember anything about the discovery of Kennicott, or is that before your time, or must have been about 1911, wasn't it?
I remember the story of Kennicott. There were 8 people in it. And the way that it was discovered, according to the tradition, that the prospectors seeking a place to pasture their pack animals saw this patch of green up the hill, and they went up to find this grass pasture, and it turned out to be copper. In case of mine, the copper. That's how the Kennicott was discovered, according to the story. And, Steve Birch promoted it. He was a government scout up here. He went back and he got Morgan Guggenheim money, and at the time they built the railroad, they only had 2 years of ore in sight. It was craziest kind of a gamble. How they could talk anybody to building that railroad. And the showing they had is one of the romances of the century, I guess.
Well, they built that bridge across the Copper River every year, didn't they?
No. There was a bridge across the Copper Chitnall. Yeah, that was a pile bridge. They built that every year.
It went out every year.
Yes. That was wide and shallow there. It could be done. It would have been glaciers there. That $1 million bridge, so called. That's the one that the earthquake shook up.
Well, did they take the ties down and all the superstructure off the bridge when they every fall when they? Yeah,
they could take everything they could off the ties. The pile driver crew there. Pulled everything into the pile. They pulled some of the piles and put it in the boat.
What's the highlights of your work with the FE? When did it terminate?
Well, the FE was, you remember, the war coming on sometime in 41, was it? In 41, I was out at a friend's house, an old prospector. Photograph Sam from what is now Fort Wainwright. Stopped to listen to the news, and the news we heard was the bombing of Pearl Harbor. Then we were in the war. And it wasn't very long before the government shut the gold mining down. And A lot of the men, a lot of the key figures were released by the British men. I was one that was retained, and I was put in charge of the store. Walter Pratt was the let out, or where he was. But anyhow, I was in charge of the store all during the wartime. We were very restricted crew, but there was lots of work to be done, and we loaned a lot of stuff to the government. We sold a lot of it to the government, and we. In fact, we had the only source of supply around here, any size. We had lots of steel, we had lots of various kinds of things that they needed, didn't have. The contractors. I had to parcel this stuff out with the management's permission now and then, of course, to various agencies that wanted it.
Tell me, were you in the at Kennecott when the Shoshana Stampede started?
No, I was in the Judo when the Shoshana Stampede started.
What year did that start?
I don't know. It must have been about 1914, something like that.
Well, it was 1912, I think.
12, was it?
Yeah, I know I very nearly went to it from Nome. I was just teetering on the edge. A young fellow in Nome. So that went back and finished college.
During this war,
and you had to parcel out so much of the equipment. Were you forced to sell most of it to the military?
It wasn't equipment, it was material, like steel and all kinds of tools and things like that that weren't in the country. The NC company, of course, had quite a stock, but it wasn't very long, but they were pulled out. Well, we had 700 tons of steel, there wasn't anything in the country. When these contractors came in, they were flying out deals from the restaurants here. They put them down in the middle of nowhere to start a camp, and they hadn't anything with them. They had to come into Fairbanks, as I say, fly out materials from the restaurants, from the grocery stores. Stocks were cleaned out in no time. And he told me to hold on to anything and pinch it to the and not let it go out except in necessity. But anything that was needed, they could have, but to hold on to it so that it would last. It wasn't to be just pulled out by one person, one company, or anything like that, but just hold on to it, and it was very precious, and it was very precious too, for some time before there was any supply in the country.
I was inspector at the time. We couldn't buy a nail from Fairbanks. I was inspector for the district engineer, U.S. district engineer. And I saw when they were making these camps down here, the carpenters reach in and grab a handful of nails. They'd drive one nail and throw the rest on the ground. And those kind of things, and you couldn't buy a nail in town. All those kind of things were going on. Well, one old fellow came to me and he was just crying. He said, "I got two sons in the service and this thing's going on here. It just makes me want to get up and shoot somebody." So there were all kinds of people in that war.
Well, it's war is waste anyhow, and that's what happens. And I'm afraid I'm...
You didn't tell us when you name your daughter, or where she is now, and her married name, and...
My daughter's name was Marjorie. She was born in 19. I was born married in 15. She was born married. She was born in 16, and she was orphaned before she was 2. My wife was just a few days, I think. Just a few days past, and just a few days before she was 22. When she died with diphtheria. They serum that they had in June wasn't effective, or they had some serum, but it wasn't effective. There were 5 deaths at that time.
Well, you may have some grandchildren, but...
No.
Is she married now?
She's married. There's no chance of grandchildren there. My son never gets married, and perhaps he may have children.
Well, you didn't tell about your son. Bill, now.
Bill was born in, married in 27. He was born in 28, I guess. Yeah, he was born in 28. It was a toss-up with his mother was going to live when he was born. In fact, the doctor told me he didn't know what that he could guarantee or have a live baby or a live wife. I went walk down the track, but when I came back after the half an hour's walk here, they'd be born.
Where was this?
The Kennicott Hospital.
Kennicott?
Yeah.
Was it a very large hospital at the time?
It was a wooden building, a very fine place, and a very fine surgeon, Dr. Peterson. He performed an operation. It's quite unique. And we always had good surgeons in Kennecott from Gillespie on. Dr. Peterson is now in Houston, Texas. He was a graduate of this it's quite a famous hospital back east.
Mayo Clinic?
No, it's the
John Hopkins?
Johns Hopkins, yes. And we had also there was three nurses on duty all the time. You see, we had quite a crew of men there, mostly about 500 or 600 men. And so there was a doctor, three nurses, one for each shift. I was a patient at the hospital, and it was very, very well run.
These were almost all working underground.
About
this was underground, practically all of it.
The mine is about underground, but this is also the induction plant, the mill. They employed probably more men in the mill than they did in the mine.
How many men worked at Latouche?
Latouche was quite a crew. There was 500 or 600 men at Latouche. We had quite a store.
Wouldn't you say there were more men in Alaska from 1910 to 19 to the First World War than there is now?
Not there is now, no.
Hmm?
Not there is now.
Of course, there were a lot of men in Nome. Nome was about 4,000 or 5,000 people.
Yeah, but now there's probably, they figure out, 250,000 people in this territory.
Well,
in the state?
About 250,000 now.
That time, sometimes I think our population was down to about 20,000 people. The whole
in the 20s, yes.
Yeah.
But before the 20s, before World War I, there were more people.
It went down from after World War I. It went down again. Every stampede would bring it up. Every time it was a see, at that time it might have been a couple of thousand people in Fairbanks. There was 2,500 in Juneau and a couple of thousand in Ketchikan, Franklin, Petersburg, where they had less than 1,000 apiece. There wasn't very many people.
Before World War I, when Kennecott and Latouche and the mines at Nome and the mines in Cleary, and there used to be 2,000 people at Cleary, I understand, and a couple thousand on Esther Creek, about 10,000 here in Fairbanks.
Yeah, it didn't last very long. I mean, I've heard all kinds of stories about Dawson, of course, out of Alaska. So some people told me there were 50,000 people there. Well,
I doubt that.
That's just somebody's opinion, you see.
Well, of course, 1900, there's about 40,000 people on the Seward Peninsula. But that is the whole peninsula,
yes,
that's all I know.
Is there anything left of Latouche? Is there even a village there? You never hear of it mentioned anymore.
No, there was no place. There was a dock there, and I think there was a dock in the store on the dock. And I believe they might have located a cannery there later, but there was nothing there at all.
Wasn't it
the head of
Clinton's
now?
No. That's in the Latouche Islands. They got nothing but deer on there now.
That was Haida, that's the head of the Portland Canal.
Haida.
Yeah. Ida. He was our geologist in the Alaska Gold, and he went down there to look at the property and called the name of the place Ida after him.
Well, whereabouts is Latouche located?
It's in Prince William Sound. Oh. It's about a half a day, wouldn't you say, out of Seward?
It's not too far from Seward. Between Cordova and Seward, anyhow, and then you used to see the sea lions, and then you'd pull into the beach of mine.
Well, what year was it you retired from the FE? Was it after the war?
I was possibly retired because I'd got to be 65. Unfortunately for me, I was 65 6 months before I'd worked 10 years for them. And that hurt me financially. It hurt my eligibility for a pension. So I didn't get a pension for that. I got some kind of a severance pay. But after I'd been severed, my successor arrived. The poor fellow got TB, and he had to go out for treatment. So I was recalled, and I worked another year there. And after that, after he came back, I retired before they fired me again, and went out to the land fee that got me a job as administrative assistant. I went out there and interviewed Jay Shearer. They sent me up to see Jay Shearer. He gave me a GS-7 to start with, which was pretty good for some reason. I asked him, the personnel lady, I said, what's remarkable about it? He said, well, you've only had two employees in the last, I think, 20 years, he said. She thought that was some kind of a recommendation. I got a GS-7, I got a very nice job. I reported in the landfill every morning. I was hauled out to Iceland at the government expense. I had to administer contract 13, that is the Universal Foods contract. That is, I was overseer of the mess halls, personnel accommodation and stuff like that. And then I worked for was recalled and brought back to land, put the ordnance, transferred to the Air Force. And the Air Force finally let the field go, and it became Fort Wainwright. I worked for the Army again. And
all this after you've been retired?
All after being retired by the. I worked nearly 13 years after I worked by the. Retired by the FE.
And would you get your pension after the extra year?
No, I never got a pension.
I think I made that a qualification of going back.
I was glad to get the job. I had to eat, so I had my wife and family. But there were, it was a nice place to work with, nice people to work with.
Was Gene Schreiber there then?
Yes. Yes, I think he was night watchman during the war. And I finally made up my mind that when I passed my 80th birthday, that I'd retire.
I'm going to do the same thing.
You mean you did work at LAD until you were 8 years old?
Yes.
You did.
I was the only distinction I ever had in my life, and became the oldest man at Fort Wainwright. my 81st birthday, about the time I was here last, on the 27th of last month.
I remember during the war, I belonged to Greetings Army, and they were supposed to guard the FE.
You
remember that?
Oh, yes, I used to go out there at 3 o'clock in the morning, 3 o'clock shift, go out there and walk up and down the right. This gentleman and I were in the Territorial Guard.
That's right. Still have my inside
so
sickness in my gun.
I gave the gun away. It wasn't any good.
Mine's a good one.
Yeah. Well, you know, I have this double Siberian parkie on one winter day, and or one evening it was, and this truck driver we were supposed to keep people from running in. They're supposed to tell who they were when they came in. And this truck driver was in a hurry, you know, and I pulled down on him. I didn't know whether to shoot him or shoot the truck tires out, but boy, he just remembered in time, you know. He jumped out of there. He could hardly walk. I was pretty imposing in that big double parkie, you know.
I was in
big
a little
reindeer parkie
down at the NC Bar House. Well, it's 10 o'clock, and I guess that'll close our tape.
Thank you very much.
This will close out. This will close out the story of Mr. Humphrey's life in Alaska, and Yukon and all Yukon Historical Society on June the 25th. This is November the 27th, 1964. We have just played this tape back, making a history of it, and I wish to inform anyone who uses this tape in the future that the noise and screeching was caused by passing the mic in front of the receiver with the power still on, and that we had just been recording for the Historical Society for a short while when this tape was made. This speaker inadvertently played with the mic a terrible lot while it sat on the table in front of him. He would touch it and move it, and each time it would make a screech on the tape. We now have to have a nice piece of felt covering the table. We had a speaker right after him who had cufflinks that were always hitting the hardwood table and making a terrible noise. And this was in the Chamber of Commerce building in Fairbanks, and on the night of this first reel, they had a meeting upstairs, and a tremendous lot of thumping that you will hear in the first reel was people walking upstairs, which was entirely out of our control. We hope it has not disturbed the value of the story in any way.